Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
6:15. I was hoping that'd be the one that says somebody you can trust because, man, I'm going to tell you what, I'm all for cool weather and I want it to cool off and I'm tired of the heat, but it's 69 degrees outside right now and going up to 82 today. I understand the humidity's lower and it's only going up to 81 tomorrow and Sunday, but it's all relative, right? Because if it, you know, if it's January and it goes up to 81, then we're saying, oh my goodness, it's a terrible heat wave. So I don't know if it's going to feel a lot cooler or not. I guess it'll feel better than 90 degrees, but humidity is going to be down. Nothing but sunshine all the way through next Saturday as it stands now, and highs in the low to mid 80s. So I guess it will feel better cool. I don't know about. Tiger Stadium's going to be heating up on Saturday night as it's homecoming for the LSU Tigers as they take on the South Carolina Gamecocks. Joining us now, Jeff Palermo. Every Friday with Jeff Palermo is Rouse's Supermarket Friday. Shop and save at Rouse's, the official supermarket of LSU. How you doing, Jeff?
Hey, I'm doing well, Tommy. How about yourself?
I am okay, sir. Tell me about your thoughts going into this game with South Carolina.
Well, it's both teams are coming off a bye week. Both teams have not had the seasons that they necessarily expected. You know, I think going into the season, if a lot of LSU fans would have said, yeah, maybe they'd be 4-1 heading into that first bye week, but with that one loss coming against Clemson. And I think the other thing when you look at LSU, no one really thought the offense would struggle as much as it has struggled. So that's why I say I think it just hasn't been the season that most people expected. It's been very frustrating to watch this offense because the defense has certainly taken the strides necessary in order for this team to play for a championship. Meanwhile, for South Carolina, they are about ready to head into the most difficult part of their schedule. I mean, they had an opportunity there in the first half of the season to really get off to a good start, but they suffered a couple of losses to Vanderbilt and Missouri. And they probably thought that they could potentially go into their first bye week with an undefeated record, but that didn't occur. And here they are, they're 3-2, and they just got a brutal, brutal schedule coming up here. You know, after they play LSU, they play four teams ranked in the top 10. So this is a game, since considering that South Carolina is rested for the most part, coming off the bye, this is probably a game they look at and say, man, we got to win. We got to win. So they come in with that mentality, and I think LSU looks at it the same way. It's you almost feel like after this first bye week, I don't want to say the season starts again, but there is a bit of a reset here to try to figure out what's been going wrong offensively for the Tigers and see if they can't get this thing on track.
Ideally, in my head, I would have LSU get it all together this weekend against South Carolina as they get into the rest of the SEC schedule, but you can't just wish it to be. There have to be reasons for it to be. Of course, there can also be reasons why it doesn't happen. Let's talk about your story about the offensive line.
Well, the Paul Mubenga looks like he is he's doubtful. So it's obviously doubtful that he's going to play coming up on Saturday night.
More like Mubanged up, right?
Yeah, he's got a high ankle sprain that he suffered in the second half of the Ole Miss game. So at starting left guard, you got to find a replacement. Now, Cohen Echols, according to Coach Brian Kelly, has been the guy that's been getting the reps with the first team at left guard. But there's been a lot of talk, a lot of speculation, especially among those that cover the team, that Carius Kern could potentially get his first start at left guard. We saw him play actually right tackle against Ole Miss. And while he wasn't perfect, I think a lot of people, he stood out, one, because he's such a talented player, but he's a physical guy, he's an intense guy, he's an emotional guy, and it just seemed like he was out there looking to try to make a difference, something that we just really haven't been seeing along this offensive line so far this season. And he actually, during spring and fall practices, he was practicing a lot at guard. So and Coach Kelly even said yesterday that he is more of a guard than a tackle. But looks like Cohen Echols will get the start if he's been getting the first team reps at practice. But I would imagine he's probably on a short hook because none of these guys really, most of them, have not been grading very well when you look at the Pro Football Focus grades after the game. So after the games that are played. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to see why this team has struggled offensively. It all starts at the offensive and defensive lines. And for LSU's offensive line, it has not performed well. So you look at it, and if that, and Brian Kelly, the other thing about this is not afraid to play a true freshman on the line. He did that with Will Campbell. He did that with Emory Jones. And Carius Kern could be that guy if Echols, or heck, even if Weston Davis is not performing very well Saturday night against South Carolina.
Well, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. One thing I love about going to the games and bringing binoculars as opposed to TV is watching, it's a team sport, but it's actually individual fights that are going on throughout the game, battles, if you will, not fights that are going on between offensive and defensive linemen, receivers, cornerbacks, etc. So we'll talk about the South Carolina defensive line when we come back, as well as the offensive performance of LSU. Maybe Caden Durham comes back, Garrett Nussmeier, etc. 621, and also about the LSU defense against the South Carolina offense. Traffic now, WWL.
I think I made it pretty clear. We have to be more consistent offensively. We have to be more productive, from an offensive standpoint. It's been on again, off again. This needs to be much more consistent in its performance. That's where our offense needs to be. Is it going to be on Saturday? I hope so. But I know the process in terms of the work that we're doing. Nothing's up for discussion. We're looking at every facet of our offense to be more consistent and have more of a balanced approach to what we're doing.
I like Brian Kelly's approach. I do. 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. Every Friday with Jeff is Rouse's Markets Football Friday. Shop and save at Rouse's, the official supermarket of LSU. So we talked about the offensive line before and the injuries, but it all depends on those battles, right? Who you're taking on, the individual battles that happen up front in a pit where you don't want to be. What about the South Carolina defensive line and linebackers?
Well, the one guy that I think you'll certainly need to keep an eye on is Dylan Stewart. This kid was a freshman All-American a season ago, and he's gotten off to a really terrific start this season as a guy that can get in the backfield. He's got 7 tackles for a loss, 3.5 sacks. He's 4th on the team in tackles, a bunch of quarterback hurries as well. And then another guy has really emerged on that defensive line as well. That would be Brian Thomas Jr. He's had a very good start to the season. He was 3rd on the team in sacks in 2024, and he starts opposite of Stewart, and he's got 5 tackles for a loss and 3 sacks. And this was a team 2 weeks ago when they played Kentucky. Now, granted, Kentucky's the worst team in the Southeastern Conference. They were able to get into the backfield and create a lot of pressure, and they had a lot of sacks, and they really got after it. And so with this LSU offensive line, that has really struggled this season, this is a big game for them to step up and try to give Garrett Nussmeier some protection in this football game.
Let's talk about Garrett Nussmeier and Lenora Sellers while we're talking quarterbacks.
Well, interesting that going before the season, these two guys were ranked 1-2 as far as on the preseason All-SEC team. Lenora Sellers got the first team honors, which I think rubbed a lot of LSU fans the wrong way, considering Nussmeier was coming off a 4,000-yard passing season. But neither of them have looked like the two best quarterbacks in the Southeastern Conference this season. Sellers has had his struggles as well. We all know that his ability to run the football is such a big part of his game, but yet he has less than 100 yards rushing. He's also been dealing with a suspect offensive line, and a lot of that is because South Carolina has been really banged up on that offensive line. They're missing multiple starters along the O-line, and it's created problems for their offense. So considering that this guy had two rushing touchdowns against LSU a year ago, a 75-yard rushing touchdown.
I remember that.
And considering also that LSU defensively has had trouble slowing down a running quarterback, I would think that's got to be in the game plan here coming up on Saturday night for them to try to get him more active in the ground game. And then he's got a big arm too. He's a guy that can throw the ball downfield. So will we see some deep passes, see them try to create some big plays with his legs and feet? I think coming off the bye week, both of these teams have been able to do a lot of self-scouting. And I think you could see these two offenses really try to take, I don't want to say necessarily take chances, but I can see them both trying to push the envelope a little bit. I could see LSU with Garrett Nussmeier, if he truly is really over this ab strain thanks to the bye week, seeing him trying to push the ball downfield. I mean, Brian Kelly said it last night. Part of their offense is throwing the ball deep on deep crossing patterns, and we haven't been able to see that this season, and maybe we see it Saturday night.
Homecoming, you like LSU's chances?
I think this is going to be a close one, Tommy. I think I got it 24-21. I know LSU's like an 8.5-point favorite, but I really think they're going to get South Carolina's best shot. And I'm still not a believer that this LSU offense is right. So until I see it, I think they're still going to have some issues scoring a lot of points, but I think they'll score enough to beat South Carolina.
Your name should be Thomas, like mine. Thank you, Jeff Palermo. We'll take a break, come back, talk about real estate in the downtown area right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Dave Cohen. 6:48, 12 till 7. I was kidding around yesterday, texting some people saying if I see one more TV meteorologist tell me that it's cold outside or that it's cool outside, I'm going to go ballistic, because I don't need the weather people to make up stuff and imagine stuff and tell me their slant on things and try to make me believe things. That's not why I watch the weather. That's why I watch the news. Kidding. But you know, the president upset about this Nobel Peace Prize, but he shouldn't be, because the nomination ended on January 31st for this Nobel Peace Prize. And I think if what he's promising in the Middle East happens, I think he's going to be the leading contender for the Nobel Peace Prize next year. But this was a very recent development, so you can't like go back and discount everything that happened before and break the rules and all that, right? If the nominations closed on January 31st, I will say this, if this happens as he says it's going to happen, and there is peace between Hamas and Israel and peace going forward, then I think he would certainly be a candidate for the Nobel Peace Prize, and somebody should nominate him by January 31st. But before you get all upset, I don't think you can feel as though you've been snubbed because you didn't get it this year, because these are very recent developments. The nominations close on January 31st, and they hand out the award on October 10th. So it's not like an instant thing or anything like that. Ali Bustamante joins us now, professor in the Department of Economics and Finance at UNO. Talk about these building bankruptcies that are going on. How you doing, professor?
Great, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. Hancock Whitney Center and our building that we're in, 400 Poydras, in default on their debt. First of all, what does that mean about maturity default?
Well, you know, when we're actually talking about maturity defaults, it's really about an ability to make ongoing payments. So, you know, the way that payments were likely structured were somewhere, you know, at a certain point in time, you know, which is now really, that payments were structured to change in a way that right now it just really doesn't make economic sense for folks to actually service them anymore.
So I don't understand, boy. You got to help me out, because I'm just a guy that owns a home, right? But when you look at the size of these buildings and the cost that it takes to maintain these things, and then you put debt service on top of it, is there a general rule of thumb about occupancy or occupancy to rate of debt that you have to have, or amount of debt that you have to have in order to not be upside down on these things?
Well, there's not really a rule of thumb per se, but you know, the idea is that it's about how much occupancy you have in these buildings, right? And when you start really getting to a point where occupancy is, you know, is dwindling, certainly, you know, at a rapid pace. And right now, you know, we look at vacancy rates in a lot of buildings. We're looking at about 25% vacancy rates in a lot of these Class A buildings right now. That's really, like a state where the math just isn't mathing anymore.
Say that again, Professor. What number was that percentage?
About 25% vacancy rate.
Yeah.
And that's really a place where, you know, you have costs being much greater than the actual revenue coming in.
And the other thing when it comes to the long-term financing of this and the capital acquisition, et cetera, every month that you have an office that's empty, that's like an unsold concert ticket. That's revenue you will never, ever see. And that goes to the long-range plan for paying off this building, right?
Exactly right. And, you know, when we're, you know, the right now, the going rate for, you know, Class A business rent, it's about $22 per square foot. And so when you're thinking about the fact that not just are this, you know, these kinds of office spaces having much less occupancy, but also the ones that do have existing office space, they're actually downsizing as well. It's really a double whammy when it comes to the ability to keep these kinds of buildings afloat.
So what happens? First of all, the real estate market for commercial buildings in downtown New Orleans, I look at all of these buildings and I can't imagine who's going to fill them. I really don't. Am I missing something?
No, you're absolutely right. Again, you know, when we look at, you know, leasing activity and vacancy rates, they're extremely elevated. You know, when we're looking at, you know, the Central Business District, like I said, you know, we have vacancy rates that are, you know, really in the, you know, in the mid 20%. And then when we're actually looking at, you know, further, you know, go to Metairie, those are pretty stable. And it's really a reflection that, you know, folks are really looking at, you know, either mixed use properties or properties that are much closer to the homes where most workers are.
So what about COVID? Was that a sea change in this, or have we rebounded from that with people not working from home anymore and going back to the office?
You know, there's been a slight rebound, but it's really a bigger shift, really, in terms of not just whether, you know, businesses are allowing folks to work from home or not. There's just been a gradual downsizing of the need for use. There's been a huge rethinking post-COVID of how much space businesses actually need, given that so much of their business has really pivoted to the e-commerce side.
So what happens with a building like the Whitney Tower or the the building we're in at 400 Poydras, ultimately?
Well, you know, the sad truth is that, you know, two things have to give. One, you know, they're going to have to try to, you know, really lower rents in a way that's going to be attractive. But the sad reality right now is that as we know, as we've seen with the CBD for over the past, you know, several years, is a lot of these spaces, even when you have relatively attractive rents, there's just really few people who can actually fill them. And so a lot of the time they do go, you know, just unoccupied for a long period of time.
See, and here's the thing, and this is way above my pay grade. I got nothing to do with any of this, but we are in one of the buildings. So I'm thinking, well, if to attract more tenants, they have a fire sale for rent. Well, then if I'm already a tenant, I'm saying, hang on a second here. If I'm paying $22 a square foot or whatever number you said, and then you're going to entice new tenants, offer $15 a square foot, let's talk about me, because then I want to go down to $15 a square foot as well, which changes the entire model again, right?
100%. And yet, you know, as you kind of, you know, alluded to in the beginning, the way that these, you know, rent contracts are oftentimes structured, you know, they do have, you know, in almost like the equivalent of an adjustable rate mortgage, basically, right? They do have the maturity on these kinds of rent premiums. That being said, you know, it's folks who have these long-term contracts who oftentimes are locked in, and it really is a you know, a move whether, you know, they choose to you know, to go with the transaction cost of actually finding a new space with less rent and being able to do the, you know, have the moving costs, having the restructuring of contracts, all of that stuff. And so it can be, a lot of landlords are going to have a difficult time restructuring them. But if the pieces are in place and you can actually have a legitimate threat of moving, I think that's where a lot of power does come out to a lot of these tenants.
So real quick, we only have a minute left. It costs a lot to maintain the building. I'm losing revenue if these spaces go unleased. However, if I continue to maintain the debt service, I am ultimately gaining a capital asset. So is there some point where the scale slides and the company says, that's it, we're closing the building, selling?
You know, I think the first step is usually that there is, you know, opportunity for conversion rates. You know, there's a lot of incentives to do a lot of like mixed occupancy buildings now. And if they can get some of those contracts, I think it's, you know, that's really a win-win for a lot of folks. You know, you get tenants that have relatively small square footage, but plus you get the ability to restructure and increase the housing supply. But as you kind of mentioned, absent those opportunities, you're really going to have a lot of vacancies on the market.
Then you got people that have already, I know we got to go 10, but have leases then, that are going to say, well, wait, I didn't move into this building because I wanted it to be a mixed residency kind of thing, right? So that opens up a new
exactly
can of worms.
Exactly right. So it really is, a very complex matter right now. But
Professor,
again,
they're screaming at me. We got to go. Thank you. I'm sorry. Ali Bustamante, professor at UNO, 657, quick leader traffic, WWL. All right, 716, false start on me. And Ozan's here, co-host of the Manning Family Football Manning Family Children's Prep Football Roundup. Morning, Ian. How are you?
Morning, Tommy. How are you?
Good to see you. And the football season flies by, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. We're already in the second half of the season. This is week six. In 5 weeks from now, we'll be opening the playoffs.
It's hard to believe. It really is.
Yeah, it goes by very quickly. You think of football as a long and plodding season, mostly because of how the NFL and college football run their schedules now. But high school is very much still a fall sport from September to December. And we're almost in playoff mode now. District seasons for the last few schools that haven't begun district play will begin district play tonight. We play these final 5 weeks, and brackets come out 4 weeks from Sunday.
You know, what throws me is that I used to think of football as a fall sport, but it really isn't, because by the time it turns cool, it's halfway over. You can't
right.
look at it that way. It's more of a summer/fall sport. Tell me where y'all are going to be tonight.
We're actually going to be in studio tonight. Since I'm doing the afternoon anchor shift, we're just going to do it from here tonight. But our games of the week this week, our Manning Family Children's game of the week, is Jesuit St. Aug. St. Aug last week lost to Etna Carr in a valiant effort. You have to give the Purple Knights credit. They were hampered offensively by injury. They were without their leading rusher, Keith Hill, but they still hung 21 points on Etna Carr, which is something that's unheard of this season. Etna Carr, I think, is averaging only 10 points or so allowed per game, and the Purple Knights had the most success against them offensively this year. Etna Carr's offense, though, St. Aug had no answer for them, the St. Aug defense, that is. One of the St. Aug offensive drives stalled at the one-yard line, couldn't punch it in. That would have changed the momentum of the game. Etna Carr then went 99 yards downfield and scored, and that was all she wrote. It was all Etna Carr after that. The Purple Knights should be able to get a boost tonight. This should be a rebound win. Jesuit's 4-1, but the competition they've played hasn't been that great. They're all around or just below 500. But if Jesuit can do what they did against Holy Cross last week, and that's run the ball, take chunks of time off the clock on every possession, they might have a chance this week. In fact, that may be Jesuit's only chance this week. They're also looking to see if their quarterback, Taylor Norton, will be able to start this week. He was out last week, but their sophomore backup, Sully Sullivan, great name, did a fantastic job.
Name, really?
That's his name. He did a fantastic job, led Jesuit to the win over Holy Cross. He landed the offense. He did a fantastic job. I think he threw for 2 or 3 touchdowns in that game. So even if Taylor Norton's not there, Sullivan is an adequate enough player that he could lead St. Aug to a victory. But again, it's going to take Jesuit to run clock and to keep St. Aug's offense off the field.
Recap that Holy Cross Jesuit game for me from last week.
So Jesuit last week, they came out fast. They came out furious. They won it big. I forget what the final score is. I'm going to have to pull it up. But Holy Cross, I don't think, was ever in that game. Mm. Jesuit came out, and from all the updates that we had from that game from Scott Phillips, it seemed as if that Jesuit was in full control from the very beginning, and Holy Cross never had a chance. chance.
Doesn't get any easier for Holy Cross this week.
No, it doesn't get any easier for Holy Cross this week. And if you're a Holy Cross fan, you have to wonder who put this schedule together, because they're starting with the three best teams in the Catholic League. They lost to Etna Carr, they've lost to Jesuit, and now they get John Curtis. Mm. Last year, at this point, a John Curtis game would have been great, because John Curtis beat itself last year. The Patriots were turning the ball over, committing stupid penalties. This year, that's not the case. JT has his team back in prime form and in the top 10 of the LSWA Class 5A standings. John Curtis is not beating John Curtis this year. Case in point, they go over. They beat Warren Easton 33-29 last week. And Warren Easton's looking much better than they did last year. Holy Cross 0-2 to start the Catholic League. I don't see them going 0-3. And John Curtis runs the ball. They run it effectively. I'd bet this game would be over by 9 o'clock.
What I think is amazing is how you all cover not just what's going on in the city, but throughout the state. Some of the other games you're looking at?
One of the other games we're looking at is Alexandria and West Monroe. And people are thinking, why in the world would you be covering this? Because if Destrehan or Hanville make a run in the playoffs, they're going to play one or both of these teams. Alexandria right now, Their average game score is 51-7. That's the average score for an Alexandria game. West Monroe is finally getting back to snuff after a few years of trying to figure out who they are as a team and a program. They went through a few head coaches, and part of that's because the parents and the alumni at West Monroe want a state championship every year. They are anal retentive about that, and if you don't get past the second or third round of the playoffs, they want the coach fired. Mm-hmm. And a few coaches couldn't handle that. They left. They finally have a coach this year that has them at 4-1. They're back in the top 10 of the 5A standings, the top 10 rankings. The question is, can West Monroe's defense slow down that Alexandria offensive attack, averaging 51 points a game? The winner of this game is likely winning District 2 5A and is going to be the favorite to make it to the Superdome in Division 1 non-select.
You'll be taking reports from all over the state tonight, won't you?
Yeah, that's one of those games we're taking reports from. We have reports from Lafayette Christian Academy against Lafayette Renaissance, which is a true rivalry game. Lafayette Renaissance is a brand new school. They've been open maybe 3 years. Mm-hmm. Their coaching staff all came from Lafayette Christian. Wow. Those coaches had a falling out with the management, the headmaster, the church that runs Lafayette Christian. So they picked up their toys and they went literally across the field to a brand new school. And now they're taking they took some of the players with them. They took some of the families, and a true rivalry has been born in the infancy of this new school. So that's one of the games we'll be tracking tonight. And of course, we'll be back here. Riverside taking on St. Martin's Episcopal. That's our Enterprise Staffing New Orleans Metro game of the week. Riverside has won every single matchup between these two schools since they began playing in 2019, when they were joined the same district 10-2A. Riverside riding an 8-game win streak. They went on the road last week, beat defending state champion Vermilion Catholic 42-19. It was 28-7 at the half. So Riverside was never in doubt in that game. St. Martin's Episcopal, meanwhile, they're looking to right the ship against Pope John Paul II. And without LSU halfback Harlan Berry, who was there at St. Martin's last year, you can tell that Riverside is struggling this, or pardon me, that St. Martin's Episcopal is struggling. Without Harlan Berry, their offense has been slow to start, and I expect the same thing tonight against Riverside.
Y'all do a great job, man. I'm going to tell you, I love listening to it. You put Friday Night Lights on the radio. Friday Night Lights, Manning Family Children's Prep Football Roundup, presented by Acadian Companies and Dr. Pepper, tonight with Ian Ozan, my high school schoolmate Lou Valden tonight.
Lou sends his love, by the way.
Well, tell him hello for me, too. 7 till 10:30 here on WWL, 723 Traffic Now, WWL. The technical issue here, we're getting resolved. We'll talk about that. Then we'll talk with Ian McNulty. He covers food and dining culture for the Times-Picayune New Orleans Advocate. And we'll wrap it up talking with JR with Taking Vegas. I always ask you to go to givinghopenola.org if you can volunteer, because a couple of your hours combined with a couple of other hours are going to create some synergy that helps feed a lot of people and makes you feel a lot better about a lot of things going on in your life. Troy Duhon joins us now. My boy Troy Duhon, fellow Shaw graduate. How you doing, Troy?
I am doing good. How you been?
I'm well, sir. Tell me about Giving Hope NOLA and a gala that's going up.
You know, Tommy, it's our 11th year, and you'd have told me 11 years ago we'd still be doing this. I said, I don't think so, but I'll be honest with you, Tommy. The need for food in this city is massive, and these lines are not getting shorter. So we're going to celebrate on November 15th at the Hilton Hotel. I got Master P coming to speak. And the cool thing about it is there's a lot of people, you know, who really want to make a difference. And helping people with food insecurity is really a blessing.
Troy, you're fading out a little bit there. Helping people with food insecurity, you were saying, before you faded out?
Yeah. Correct. Helping people with food insecurity is a great way to start. But one of the cool for the local high schools send their students to volunteer. So if your school or even where your children go to school that need volunteer hours, you should try sending them to Giving Hope. Because, Tommy, when Miss Betty gets done with them, I tell you this, they're a whole new kid, I promise you.
Tell me about the gala for people that want to go, Troy. How do they get tickets?
Sure, givinghopenola.org. It's at the Hilton Hotel, November 15th. You can just go online, buy individual tickets. It's close to selling out. We expect about 1,000 people, Tommy. And it's really a great opportunity for people to really see what's happening in New Orleans from everywhere, from food insecurity to substance abuse. And it's really a great time. It's fun. It's festive. You've been there. You've emceed it. It's a great time.
It's the highlight of my November. I got to tell you that. It really is. Thank you, Troy. A pleasure talking to you as always. And if y'all want to volunteer, go to givinghopenola.org. 7:30, Clancy Dubose. We come back right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Dave Cohen. All right, 7:45, quarter till 8. I don't need to tell you that Election Day is tomorrow, just from the preponderance of political ads that you're hearing and reading and seeing. Clancy Dubose joins us now, our friend, WWL Louisiana political analyst, to talk about it. How you doing, Clancy?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. You know, I wanted to ask you, compared and contrasted to other mayoral elections in New Orleans where there has not been an incumbent, where does this one stand in your opinion? The campaign so far.
Yes, it reminds me a little bit, just in some ways, not in every way, of the election at the end of Ray Nagin's term, mm-hmm. when Mitch Landrieu ran and won in the primary. I'm not predicting that will happen, but what is similar is that there was a front runner. The minute that Landrieu got in, he became the front runner, and he stayed the front runner all the way through Election Day. And that's what has happened here. Plus, it was an election where the city was dysfunctional at that time, and the people, voters, black and white, were looking for someone who could end the dysfunction, someone who knew what to do and knew how to do it. And that was, in fact, Mitch Landrieu's sales pitch. I know what to do and I know how to do it. That has not been Helena Moreno's sales pitch, but it's similar to the way she has presented herself. The voters knew Landrieu. Voters this time know Moreno. Again, I'm not saying she's going to win, but she has been the front runner in every poll taken, and nothing has changed that. So the big question tomorrow is, can she win this outright in the primary, or will there be a runoff? And it was the same question that people were looking at in 2010 when Landrieu ran. But the difference is Helena Moreno was the first candidate to announce in this race. Landrieu was the last candidate to announce in 2010. Every election is a unique event. There are similarities and contrasts with every election, but certain things are sort of locked in. You know, you have to have a campaign. You got to get your message out. And you got to go through certain mechanics, like, you know, get out the vote efforts and things like that. But those are structural similarities. But in terms of how they play out and what the issues are and where voters are at any given moment in time, those are always unique qualities or attributes to every single election, regardless of the office. And, of course, this election, too, is going to be a unique event.
If you could summarize, you mentioned sales pitches. How would you summarize Helena Moreno's sales pitch? How would you summarize Oliver Thomas's sales pitch? How would you summarize Royce DuPlessis' sales pitch?
Moreno's sales pitch has been, you know me, I've been here for you. She's a known quantity, and I'm not just coming to your churches and your fairs at election time. I've been doing that as a reporter and as an elected official, and she's been accessible and responsive. That's a similar sales pitch to Oliver Thomas. He's someone who's a known quantity. And he's a little more of a retail politician. You know, he came up, he's more old school. Moreno is more of a modern politician in the sense of very telegenic, much more into social media than say Thomas perhaps, but he's a guy, boots on the ground kind of guy. And, you know, I'm the guy you know, I'm the guy you've seen, I'm the guy you could run into at the coffee shop, and when you need me, I'm here for you.
Listen up, football fans, you won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
And then the Royce Duplessis his sales pitch is, this should be an election, not a coronation. You know, I'm the new guy. I'm the outsider. The other two have been part of the problem. They've been in city government, and yeah, they know it, but what have they done about it kind of thing. So that's the three different sales pitches.
Now, let me take a break. I want to talk about sheriff and council races when we come back.
Sure.
Clancy Dubose, our guest, by the way. Congratulations. One of the newer inductees into the, Louisiana Political Hall of Fame?
Yes, sir.
Congratulations on that. That's quite
nice. Thank you very much. I'm very grateful.
But don't get confused. That doesn't mean you're done. It doesn't mean it's time to hang them up, all right?
Okay.
You just keep working. All right, 7:50, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:57, 3 till 8, couple of minutes left with Clancy Dubose, a friend, WWL, Louisiana political analyst, talking about the election tomorrow. And it's not just Orleans Parish. You need to go to WWL.com. You can see every parish and everything that's up for grabs, if you want to call it that. Let's talk about the sheriff race in Orleans Parish. Clancy, thoughts on the campaigns run by the three candidates?
Yeah, here again, you have a front runner, Michelle Woodfork. As soon as she announced, she became the front runner. She remains the front runner. But the difference between that and the mayor's race is you have an incumbent, a very weakened and controversial incumbent, Susan Hudson, who's been holds the distinction of actually going down in the polls after the election started qualifying. Of course, you had the, in the wake of that jailbreak, 10 people, and the last one finally was captured in outside Atlanta, you know, a couple of days ago. And then a challenger also from Algiers, Second City Court Constable Edwin Shorty. But, you know, Shorty's actually in the polls ran behind even Hudson. He's had difficulty gaining traction on the East Bank. But Michelle Woodfork, again, sort of like Helena Moreno, someone with a name that people know. And she had she served as the interim police chief for about a little less than a year. And, you know, seemed to bring some stability to the NOPD and did bring stability to NOPD and presided over the beginning of a significant drop in violent crime and crime overall in New Orleans. And so she has been the front runner from day one and is potentially could win it all tomorrow.
I firmly believe they picked him up as soon as they had the opportunity to get Derrick Groves, but just timing with the election. I can make a case that this could help Susan Hudson. I can make a case that this brings it all back and it could hurt her, or it could have no difference at all. What do you think?
Well, I think it just kind of reminds people that there were 10 people who escaped overall. And it was like, most people said, well, it's about time. And of course, it was not so much her office that captured them as federal U.S. Marshals.
And, right. Oh, yeah.
people like that. So
St. Bernard had a lot to do with it, too, they tell me.
Yes, yes.
Thank you, Clancy. Any final thoughts?
Yeah, we got some interesting council races, too. So there's plenty of reasons to get out and vote if you live in Orleans Parish. If you didn't vote early, we had a wonderful big turnout for early voting, so there seems to be a lot of interest in this race. And I'd like to see a big turnout because that's good for democracy.
Amen.
Regardless of who wins, who loses.
Thank you, sir. 8:15 Friday morning. It is a Rouse's Markets Football Friday. Every Friday with Mike DeTillier is Shop and Save at Rouse's, the official supermarket of the Saints. We break down the Saints roster and the New England Patriots roster, the opponent this week's roster, and matchups and see how they do. And we welcome in Mike DeTillier now. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing great, Tommy. Thank you.
Let's talk about, Saints defense versus the New England Patriots offense. And let's start with Drake May.
He's one of the young stars in his business. Coming out of North Carolina, my comparison was Andrew Luck coming out of Stanford and what he did for the Colts. Big, tall kid, athletic. He can make every throw that you're looking for. Last year, he didn't start the season. It was Jacoby Brissett. And then about seven games into it, they gave him the ball. He looked god-awful the first three or four games of the year. But by the end of the year, Tommy, you could see he had gotten it. And you watch this year, he's completing over 70% of his throws. Mm. I mean, he's accurate, he's smart, knows where to go with the football downfield. Still young in this business, so every once in a while he'll turn that ball over. But he's the straw that makes the drink turn, so to speak,
The
Pats.
Compare and contrast, maybe this would be a way to look at it, the Patriots offense with the Giants offense.
Well, with Jackson, Dart, he's doing a lot with his feet right now. He's making a lot of plays with his feet as just trying to get away from a lot of heavy traffic. And it's a little bit different offense because, you know, they have Stephon Diggs, the Patriots do. The Giants no longer have Malik Nabers. And the Patriots have two tight ends that are really good, two experienced guys in Hunter Henry and Hooper who have played in this league a long time. The Giants have a couple young tight ends. So it's a much younger roster, much more developing roster with the Giants than the Patriots. Despite the fact the Patriots' left side of their offensive line are two rookies. One of them is Will Campbell from LSU. It's a little bit different offense than what we saw with the Giants. I think a lot of energy from both quarterbacks. That's the similarities. You can see they're the guys that can put the battery cables, you know, on that battery. They got a certain spark to them. And, you know, sometimes with a young quarterback, he tries to do too much, like we saw Dart after the first quarter last week, tried to do too much. And then last night against the Eagles, he was terrific. Him and Scatterboot carried that team. And they out-physicaled the reigning champs. They really did. So it's a little different offense, but a lot of change. You know, we talk about the Saints with 28 new players on the team from a year ago. The Patriots got 26. Mm. You know, Mike Vrabel came in here. Man, what? This team won four games. I'm not putting up with this. These guys got to go. And I'm going to bring in my guys. And that's what he did. He brought in his guys. And it has paid off so far. They've kind of gotten some confidence in what they do offensively and defensively. Mike has a certain style of play. When he was with the Titans, he had Derrick Henry. They ran the football. And they're going to try to run it against the Saints. But he ain't never had anyone as good at quarterback in Tennessee like he's got with Drake May. Mm-hmm. Ryan Tannehill, come on. He's not in the same category of what eventually we're going to see out of Drake May.
So let's talk about another LSU Tiger, Kayshon Boutte, and you got who's he going to line up against or who's going to line up against him?
Yeah, with Kayshon, you know, he had a real weird career at LSU where early on he looked like a superstar player, and then it sort of came apart with him, and he fell really hard on draft day, but he sort of pieced it together now. One thing for sure, with Stephon Diggs on one side, you never have to worry about no double coverage.
No.
I mean, he's one-on-one, and they move him around. It's the one thing with Josh McDaniels' offense. They move their receivers around where it's not always going to be a one-on-one all the time with, say, a Kool-Aid McKinstry or a Quincy Riley. He likes to move guys around. They love to play a lot of 12 personnel, two tight ends. That's something you're seeing more and more in the NFL because there are more big athletic guys playing tight end. And so, again, it goes back to what Mike Rabel likes to do, and that is to run the football. And so it would be a lot of Stevenson and the rookie, who I think will have a bigger play in this game, and that's Travion Henderson, former Ohio State star running back.
Josh McDaniels, the offensive coordinator. Some guys are great coordinators, maybe not so good at being a head coach, right? That's not for everybody.
It's sometimes hard to connect with the big room. He's the NFL's version of Wade Phillips today, where it didn't work for Wade as a head coach. But, boy, he is one hell of a coordinator. And you look at the success Josh had working with Tom Brady in New England, and now what he's done to develop Drake May. Josh McDaniels knows what he's doing on offense. But, you know, some guys just aren't built to play the big room. And last year, Robert Kraft, you know, he hired Gerard Mayo, former NFL player, who was the defensive coordinator for Belichick. Mm-hmm. He was the man in waiting. But it was almost overwhelming for him. To be the head coach. There's one thing with Mike Rabel, it ain't overwhelming with him. And Tommy, if you ever got in a fist fight out on the street and it was a couple dudes, you want Mike Rabel on your side. You don't have to face him.
All right, let's take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back 8:22. We'll talk about Saints offense against the Patriots defense and LSU Tiger Kalevon Chasson on the in a linebacker's position. 8:22 traffic now. WWL. Every Friday here at WWL is Mike Detailier, Rouse's Market Football Friday. Shop and save at Rouse's, the official supermarket of the Saints. 8:28, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Mike, when the Saints are on offense and the Patriots are on defense, what are we looking for?
When Coach Rabel took over in New England, first thing he said, we're going to win on defense, and we all about stopping the run. And they've been one of the top teams in the NFL stopping the run this year. And he went out and made a lot of changes, especially in that front seven, bringing in veterans. You brought up Kalevon Chasson, Harold Landry, who he had with him with the Titans. Christian Barmore was there, but he's played some really good football. They went and get Milt Williams, who played his college ball at Louisiana Tech but was with the Eagles along their defensive line. So they're stout stopping the run. But, Tommy, they've given up a lot of big plays in the passing game.
Mm-hmm.
That they have done. And so he hasn't been too happy about the coverage part of things, and he let them know about it despite the win against Buffalo on Sunday night. So their strength has been to stop the run and get you to throw the football. But other teams have hit some big plays with them over the top, and that has to do with affecting the quarterback.
Chase
really,
Young
really does. They haven't been able to get a tremendous amount of pressure on quarterbacks this year.
Might be seeing Chase Young. He's limited practice yesterday again, and what's his name's out of the concussion protocol, I believe, Justin Reed, because he was full practice yesterday. You see the Saints winning or not, Mike?
I think this is a close game at home. The difference is, to me, Drake May. I think the Patriots win this game, but I think it's close, Tommy. I really do. And listen, they're coming off an emotional game. And still a team that's kind of finding their own identity as a football team, as a group, beating Buffalo in Buffalo the way they did. And they out-physicaled the Bills in that football game. But I just think when you got a guy like May, he's going to make a few more plays. I think the Patriots end up winning this. It's a close game. But you know what? You got an opportunity here to hit some big plays.
Yep.
And that could be tilt the scales your way.
I think the Saints win, and you know how they win, Mike? They win on a last walk-off field goal by Blake Groupie that gets his confidence back.
I would hope so, because, Tommy, you know, like any other kicker, yep. You on really thin ice now. They've given him a lot of leeway to work this out, and hopefully he can come out of that slump.
And he can't be hurt, because I don't think he'd have made that tackle that he did
hurt.
If he was hurt.
No, it's between the ears.
Yep,
he's like every kicker that goes through this. It's between the ears. And he's talked about, you know, maybe, you know, I'm rushing the kick, or maybe I'm not getting to the kick quick enough. Mm-hmm. So he's playing it through his mind, trying to talk himself into, hey, just go back to doing the fundamentals, which you've always done.
That's what he needs to do. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. We'll listen
to you
throughout the weekend, Mike Dettelier. We'll take a break and back talk to Michael Glasser, president of Pano, about the consent decree right now. Time for WWL First News. So that we go to Dave Cohen. There has been movement. First of all, it's 8:47. I'm Tommy Tucker, WWL. There's been movement on the consent decree as it relates to NLPD, I think. Michael Glasser, president of Pano, joins us now to help sort it out. How you doing, Mike?
Good morning, Tommy.
I should say Captain Glazer. You've been on a job how long now? 46 years? I always
confuse
I'm
in year 49.
49 years. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to short shrift you there. Tell me about where do we stand with the consent decree now?
Well, we're waiting for the Fifth Circuit to rule on it, because what happened was the city filed a motion to get out of the consent decree. The DOJ opposed it a few months back, and then it was appealed to the Fifth Circuit. Meanwhile, the DOJ has now entered with the city into an agreement to end the consent decree. So what happens now is the judge has to wait for that ruling from the Fifth Circuit. If they agree with the city, then the consent decree is gone. If they don't agree with the city, then it gets remanded back to the judge. But now that the judge has agreed to get rid of it because of the joint motion, she'll get rid of it then. So it'll be gone. It's just a matter of exactly when.
How does that change things for your membership and for the officers on the street?
Well, let me say first and foremost, you know, the first thing to consider is the cost. We spent probably close to $150 million over the course and life expectancy of this consent decree. And right now the city is upside down. We're I've heard numbers anywhere from $60 million to $100 million overdrawn. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem. And this will help alleviate that cost just by not having to spend that kind of money for monitors and all of the intended oversight. However, what it means for the members is we don't have the degree of repetitive and redundant oversight, which means our labor goes down, being as that we're unfortunately short of labor, and it's not improving going forward. So it's less that we'll have to do to maintain what we already have, and that's going to be important. And for those people that I've heard and said, oh, well, the consent decree's gone, we're going to go back to the old ways, there are no old ways. Our operations manual now reflects the 490 paragraphs of the consent decree. So that's our rule. That's our operating rule. There is no old way. And most of the cops that are here now have been hired in the last 12 years have never been under anything but a consent decree. Mm-hmm. They don't know any other way. So they don't know what that means even. So for those people that are concerned that things are going to change, they're really not. What changes is the amount of labor we have to put into oversight that is repetitive and redundant and takes time away from us doing our job.
One thing I've heard former Chief Serpas talk about is, and especially as it relates to the new mayor, the correct number of officers. Do you have any idea what the correct number of officers is?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that depends on how you're considering it. We have on paper probably 850 or so officers on paper. What I mean by on paper is that we have a significant number of officers who are on either limited duty or out. They could be on military leave. They could be out recuperating from surgery. They could be waiting for disciplinary issues, any one of a variety of things that renders them unable to work the street, but they're still commissioned officers on paper. Once we remove that, we're probably a wee bit under 800 altogether.
Mm-hmm. So as far as what the proper number would be, a right number, a necessary number, how do you determine that?
Well, it depends, again, that depends on how you look at it. Going back to 2010, we had almost 1,600 officers. Going forward, we're now at 800. However, the superintendent, I've heard, feels that we could do well with 1,200. 1,200 at this point would be a welcome change from the 800. So we're still significantly down, and 1,200 is a long way off.
So when it comes to pursuing suspects, somebody texted in, and chases, how does a consent decree affect that? Because I know Troop NOLA operates under different rules, right?
Or do they do. They're not under a consent decree, so they do whatever they think they need to do, and according to the rules of the state police. I don't see our pursuit policy changing dramatically. I think you may see some minor changes and whatnot, because you don't want to have a no pursuit policy. That's dangerous. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you can't be cavalier about it. It has to be strictly controlled and monitored. So I think you're going to see a few changes maybe, but nothing drastic.
One other thing I want to ask you, and I know you can't speak for the department here, but the perception to me is that carjackings are going up throughout your 49 years on the job. Is that a crime that's kind of cyclical in nature almost as far as your experience? I know you're not speaking for the department here, but just from your experience, or if you'd rather not weigh in, that's okay too.
No, well, carjackings are like many other crimes. They are cyclic. You know, you'll see that there's national trends that go that way, and then there's local trends that go that way. We're doing relatively well with crime. Crime has gone down significantly from 2023 to 2024, and from 2024 to now, we're still maintaining a significant reduction. However, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see that start to reverse, because we have some problems. And the problems are, number one, we have not increased our personnel. Overtime is now going to be very, very, very slim based on that upside-down budget that I just mentioned. So we have some problems with that as well. And we're going to go to a new reporting system, which will probably count crime differently. So you may see a spike in numbers that way because of the way we count crime. It's a different national computer setup that the government tracks, and I think you're going to see a little uptick just by the numbers alone, by the way it's counted. So I think you're going to see crime go up a little bit going forward, but hopefully we'll try to maintain that reduction that we've enjoyed for the last 2 years.
Thank you, Captain. I appreciate your time. Be safe out there.
We'll do it. Thank you, Tommy.
You bet. Captain Michael Glasser, president of Pano, 853 and a half. Traffic now, WWL. Ian, you got me muted, perhaps?
No, sir. I'm right here.
Okay, I thought maybe when I was knighting you with the sword, I may have knocked out your earpiece or something.
Yeah, you have to be careful with the saber. You know, gentle with the saber on me, Tommy. It's
saber, hardly even knew her. Hey, so how you doing today? What's going on? Where you been eating? Where you been drinking?
Tommy, great to be back with you. And it's been a span of some new places and some places that have been around so long that they're actually marking significant anniversaries. And that's, you know, the way it goes in New Orleans. We're always interested in what's new, what's next, what's around the corner, but also just going back and getting just reconnected and reaffirmed of the good places we have in our backyard. Just a quick one I wanted to point out. This place just opened last week, and I'm excited about it. It's in downtown, in the CBD, on Poydras Street. It's a Mexican place called Taqueria Carnalitos. Mm-hmm. And we've got a lot of Mexican restaurants around town, but this one turned my head because of a different concept. If I say fast casual, I think you get it. It's like, you walk up to the counter, you order, and then bish bash bosh, they get you fed. This is Subway is the model here, Jimmy John's. Mm-hmm. Well, if you go to Mexico City, a lot of the great taco stands are just like that. You walk up, you see the food they got, they assemble it, they and moments later you're holding a warm tortilla cradling hot grilled meats or stewed meats, whatever the filling is, drizzle on the salsa. And that's just the way it goes at this place, Taquerias Carnalitos. But it has this buzz and energy to it that just, to me, it sets it up perfectly as that spot you want to go into for that quick bite when you've got 20 minutes for lunch downtown. You don't have an hour. You got 20 minutes. You just want to grab something quick. Or probably the highest and best use, it's after 10 o'clock and this place keeps late hours and you're coming off the back of something like an event at the Sanger or the Civic, which is right around the corner, or the Dome, or you're out in the French Quarter and dinner has worn off, right? You had dinner. At dinner is hours ago in the rearview mirror and you need a little something. So you duck into a place like this. You get yourself a steak taco or two, maybe a beer out of the ice chest. There's other people around. You're not even sitting. This is not a table. This is not tables, never mind table service. You're just hitching an elbow on a counter against the rail there, watching the other people, hearing the Latin music pulsing about. And you're a changed person after getting two more tacos in your belly and you're on your way. And we have a lack of that kind of thing in New Orleans, that quick, fast, it's basically street food, but inside with air conditioning, thank goodness. And so that's why I'm glad for this new addition. Same people have a couple of real flash places called Tacos del Cartel. There's one in Metairie, then there's one on David Drive, and there's one just around the corner in the CBD from their new place. And Tacos del Cartel are fancy is not quite the right word, but much more to do. They're kind of upscale, casual Mexican restaurants with a lot of design. Like you walk in and it's just like this Instagrammable wonderland of Mesoamerican Mexican design motifs. The bartender will be breathing fire. I'm not making that up. That's not an exaggeration. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they literally do little tricks where they breathe fire as they're preparing specialty cocktails. So they're quite showpieces. But this new place, Taquerias Carnalito, much more straightforward. Just give me the taco and a beer, man, and I'm here for it. I think we need more places like that are quick, no nonsense, good value, get you on your way with something that's not fast food. So that was the debut that I've appreciated the most in the past week.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it wonderful that we live in a place where I can say that? Like, just in the past week, you know?
Absolutely.
Of the new places that I've opened, just one. But then we have places that have been around forever. Last Saturday, had a busy day, made it out to the Fried Chicken Festival in between the rain. It was great. It was great to see that. And all of the vendors out there making people really happy with their chicken sandwiches, including, I know you had Ralph Brennan on your show earlier in the week to talk about the horrific events that befell that restaurant family with the loss of their chef. Not tragically, but horrifically. Tragedy for the family, but horrific for us as a society that happened. But to see that restaurant family come together and still go out there to the festival and serve the sandwich that chef created and make it a tribute to him and to his family, and to see people get it and turn up and thank them and connect with them in a tough moment was really nice. That shows a lot of the connection through the restaurant world that we share as restaurant connoisseurs and aficionados and customers and supporters. And it's a heck of a good sandwich too, I have to say. Great bread, great chicken. It was kind of a peak chicken sandwich. But that was only part of Saturday. The earlier part of Saturday was spent going to a place called Laurel Street Bakery, which, where is it, Tommy?
Laurel Street?
Nope.
Doggone
it. One would think.
You set the trap and I walked right into it. Dadgummit.
Broad Street. It's on South Broad by the pumping station. It is one of the great misnomers of New Orleans that Laurel Street Bakery is not on Laurel Street. Of course, it started there. That was the origin story. And it started there 20 years ago. And so Hillary Gutman, the founder, she and her crew were marking 20 years in business last week and continuing the celebration for as long as the balloons will last, I suppose. But it was lovely. Tommy, this is a little place. It's a blink and you miss it kind of spot, and people kind of zoom along that area of Broad Street, so it's easy to you might actually just be blinking and missing it. But there's a reason it's been around for as long as it has. Takes perseverance, of course, by the operation itself, the proprietor. But it takes that connection with people that become regular, weekly, sometimes in some few cases that I know of for sure, daily customers. And this is how certain restaurants and bakeries and cafes and shops become. It's kind of the the rhythm of your life, piece, part of your neighborhood, part of your experience living in the city. This is a terrific little place. It's just your quiet, calm, grounding cup of coffee, bagel, a sandwich that on, you know, freshly made bread in the back of the bakery, not a po' boy, just a quick cafe deli type sandwich, maybe even a healthier one that's not going to put you back to sleep, but some sweets to bring back to the office and share with your colleagues. King cakes in season, of course, only in season. You know, cakes through the year, those special event things that that bakeries provide us with, and just like a brief little respite from the day or a good start to the day over a breakfast plate. And it was really touching to see people take time out of their Saturday on a Saturday morning to turn up to Laurel Street Bakery and pack the place just to congratulate this small business on being open and being part of their lives. And, hugging each other, exchanging stories. I don't need to tell you that 20 years ago was the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, which this place is actually tied to that. Hillary had opened Laurel Street Bakery on Laurel Street, deep uptown, right around the corner from Octavia Books, in the fateful month of August 2005, had been open for really just a few days because she was operating the bakery cafe part only on weekends. So it only had a few days under her belt when the storm hit. Of course, everything shut down. But being, you know, up way up there on the sliver by the river, was able to get back open on the day that water was declared safe to consume in New Orleans for the places that had water flowing. And that was October 4th. So that was last weekend. And so they decided to make that their 20-year anniversary. You know, if you could name your own birthday, would you rather have it a couple of days before Hurricane Katrina or on the back end when things were coming back and you were in, you know, part of the revival mode? I'd pick the latter, and so did they. And so that was great to see. And it was a reminder that these little places are there and they don't make a lot of noise and they don't turn up on your algorithm on your feed very much because they're just doing their thing, plugging away. But these people are getting up every day and making really good bagels and bread and cakes and sandwiches. And sometimes, you know, all these anniversaries come around a lot. We have a lot of businesses out there that thankfully last for a long time. But sometimes one will come along like that with a zero at the end of it and just make you think about the place again. So it was good to connect with them.
Laurel Street Bakery, and where is it?
On Broad Street, of course. the thing is, she had expanded for a while that she had two locations. She had the original on Laurel Street and then this other one over on Broad. And then, you know, businesses evolve, things happen, and dropped the original location, but kept the name because it had a lot of equity in it. And so, you know, New Orleans people in the know, they'll find Laurel Street Bakery right there on Broad Street, right where you expect it. And speaking of new debuts, though, Tommy, another one that really opened my turned my head is at the original location of Laurel Street Bakery. I know we're getting a little bit who's on first year, but at the original Laurel Street Bakery location on Laurel Street, there's a new cafe called Cafe Malou, and just opened maybe 2 weeks ago. It is a breakfast, lunch kind of place. Charming. Just this kind of a country cozy feel when you walk in that you want at a breakfast spot. You know, sunny, little curtains in the windows. You just want to get into a corner and catch up with a friend over a coffee or just get a breakfast plate with the print newspaper open. Or perhaps tuck into a book for a moment or two because – this cafe is not just next to Octavia Books. It actually connects to it. If you go on my best place to see it is probably my Instagram feed, Ian McNulty Nola. I've got a cool little shot, a video of how if you're in Octavia Books, which is a wonderful neighborhood bookshop, independent bookshop that has expanded massively, which feels, I don't know, a little bit like a print newspaper expanding or a blacksmith shop, you know, opening a grand second location. But this bookstore, and I love it, part of their renovation was the series of bookshelves that pivot, that turn open, their pivot doors.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Fee and fees apply. In app only.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
They can be closed off and they're just bookshelves lining the wall, but then they pivot open to reveal this cafe on the other side right there, these tables and booths and people having baked eggs and French toast, avocado toast and cookies and sandwiches. And it's a delight. I can't tell you the response that I've gotten from people who just, they love books, they love brunch. And here's a place that literally connects them. You're walking through the bookshelf into the brunch cafe, and that's Cafe Malou way uptown on Laurel Street. And it's a really, really charming addition all on its own, frankly, but also with its literal connection to the bookshop next door.
Let's take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. We're underway with Ian McNulty, a little table talk. You got questions about where to eat, where to drink, where you've been eating or drinking. Maybe you're going to a destination place. You want some advice because Ian's been there before. 504-260-1870. We'll return when we come back on WW. Wait, of course we're going to return. We'll come back and then we'll continue on WWL. So let me tell you what happened before we were going to the break, Ian McNulty. I went to Laurel Street Bakery, and I was looking at a picture of a chocolate strawberry cake. And it's a beautiful chocolate cake with chocolate buttercream icing with chocolate-covered strawberries on top. And as if that's not enough, in the background, I got a picture of the pumping station. And that's what got my attention and distracted me, because I thought, you know what? Only in New Orleans would you have a picture of this beautiful cake and a pumping station all at one time.
Yes, the divine and the not-so-divine, yeah. Right? The pragmatic.
Tell me where else you've been eating. What else you've been discovering?
Well, here's another anniversary. This one is 25, and it's for this restaurant downtown. And Tommy, I was sat there for dinner this week. It was a Wednesday night, nothing out of the ordinary. It wasn't a big, you know, night out on the town or anything. But I'm sitting there and I'm wondering, wait, is this a restaurant that's been around for 25 years and feels like almost as permanent as the streetcars rattling past its windows? Or is this like the hot new place that some influencer from out of town just blew up when they dropped a reel on it? Like, is this, like, what is this place? Is this the restaurant where I'm tucking into a bowl of gumbo, as I am, of chicken and andouille gumbo that tastes like I'm in Southwest Louisiana and Cajun Prairie of Acadiana? Or is it the restaurant where I'm having a amberjack crudo sliced and gently layered between crisp slices of apples with like a little flicker of grated ginger on top of it, as if I'm in a Japanese sushi bar? And the answer was yes to all of those things, because I was at Herb Saint, which is the Donald Link restaurant that started everything, his first restaurant, that this year marks 25 years in business. And it can be, again, it can be kind of arbitrary to celebrate these anniversaries. Believe me, given my job, I get pitched things all the time. Hey, it's our 7th anniversary. We're having a big party. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, congratulations. It's anniversary number 3. Like, you know, these are all very meaningful for the people who run the businesses and who work there, and of course, possibly for some of their really close customers. But for most of us, it's like, okay, great. I'm glad you're around. But then something like a 25 anniversary comes around for a place like Herb Saint, and it does make you think back to like, whoa, this place has been around for that long.
That's hard for me to believe.
And not only that, but we have restaurants that have been around for a century in this town, but it's been as good and consistent as it's been through all that time, while also changing so that it always feels fresh. Like, I had that feeling. I was sat there with my partner, Anna, in this room. She had never been before, so it was her very first time. But being in there made me think of every time that I've been in the room before, including the very first time when it was actually Susan Spicer who was introducing a chef, her sous chef that nobody really had heard of, named Donald Link. Mm-hmm. And this was in the year 2000. And, Susan Spicer was showing off this new place. And those of us in the media were like, oh, okay, this looks like it's going to be a really nice addition. Who's this Donald Link guy? Well, Donald Link went on to buy out Susan Spicer, his one-time partner at the restaurant. And Herb Saint became his place and became the place where he built his team, where he found his future partners for other restaurants, and where he built everything that became his restaurant group, which is now a hit maker unparalleled, I think, with anything else in town. They open restaurants, and they're terrific. That's what they do. And the way that Motown pumped out hits, Donald Link and his crew, they make great restaurants. But the tone was set. The template was set with what they do at Herb Saint. And so you go to Herb Saint now, and there are dishes that have been on the menu since forever. That gumbo, the duck leg confit, something they call kind of humbly house-made spaghetti, which is really like this incredibly rich pasta carbonara with a fried egg on top that you slice open. So the yolk goes into the creamy sauce, and then you mix that with some of the guanciale, one of the funnest words from the Italian salami selection to say, guanciale. And you have this incredibly rich dish, and it's been on the menu for so long that people make little tributes out of it. I knew a woman who rides in muses who made a tribute shoe just in honor of this spaghetti dish, which is wonderful. Thank you, God, for being New Orleans. And then you have... But there's always something new on the menu when you come in. So it's not just the specials, but it's whatever the chef is fascinated with that's coming through. And right now that happens to be a lot of Japanese dishes. So you think Japanese dishes next to gumbo and some Italian and some French, but it works because it's all done with a consistent hand and the same standard. And so it's not a discordant sort of mishmash of stuff. It's a really interesting selection of different dishes, all under the same roof with the same style and the same ethos. And so happy 25th anniversary to Herb Saint. All month they're doing special menus in addition to the regular longstanding menu. And again, just sitting there, I could tell, you can tell when you're surrounded by locals or when you're surrounded by out-of-towners. This was a mix of both. You know, the out-of-towners were, had backpacks, they were tumbling out of Ubers and out of big black Suburbans pulling up outside. The place has definitely made it on the list for people from out of town to visit, even though it's not all that flash. It's not this big, showy, new kid on the block kind of thing. You know, I mentioned the influencers earlier. Like, I don't see people like flashing the place up on social media. And yet it just has this consistent draw for the quality of the food, for the quality of the whole program that they're running there. And it really showed by having another dinner there again, and it was great. So I'm glad we have places that are that long running in our midst that keep on being fresh and exciting while carrying on the things that you love about them.
All right, somebody texted in, wants to know about Joey K's on Magazine Street.
I was just there recently.
Oh, yeah.
True story. That was one of the first restaurants I visited in New Orleans when I was here as a newbie, right off the turnip wagon. That made me think, this New Orleans food thing really has something going on. Mm-hmm. This was maybe one or two owners ago, so this is going back in time. But I went in recently to reconnect with it, and it's much as I remember. It's a neighborhood spot that still carries on a lot of the old-fashioned New Orleans dishes. So, the regular menu, it's po' boys, it's... it's gumbo, it's fried seafood platters, but then it goes a little deeper with like that old fashioned pot cooking, stewed chicken. I think they still do a corned beef and cabbage once a week. You have to check the date, but it's one of those daily special kind of places. And it's covered in all this, be nicer, leave, who's your mama kind of word art, mm-hmm. that can look a little, I mean, if you just pass by, look in the window, it might look a little like a tourist shop or something, but it's a spot in the Garden District that really does carry on a lot of low key, local New Orleans cooking traditions, and it's a nice neighborhood spot, and it's great for people who are strolling up and down Magazine Street as visitors to discover, too.
Somebody's going to Valencia in downtown Covington after many of their friends recommending it. Have you tried it, Ian, and do you recommend it, and what would you suggest they order?
Yes, this is a Spanish, but sort of modern Spanish place right in downtown Covington. Part of that really nice, I love to see it, kind of rejuvenation of downtown Covington through the restaurant scene. It's right around the corner from the Southern Hotel. It's not traditional, oh my gosh, we're in Spain Spanish, but it's Spanish with a bit of a Louisiana flex, a little bit of a twist, you might say. I would say try a couple things, go a tapas style, get a few of the small plates that look good to you, and then anchor it all with like a larger dish. If they've got their paella there, get that.
Ian, real quick, somebody wants to know if anything's going on at Katie's in Mid-City.
There's always something going on at Katie's in Mid-City.
But no trouble or anything?
No. That place is running strong. Backstreet place, easy to forget about, actually, because it's off of Canal and off of the Enville. It's on that middle street there, Iberville. But there's always a buzz in there. And that's a place when people ask me, oh, it's a great place to go with a small group or something. Upstairs at Katie's always comes to mind. You're getting char-grilled oysters, you're getting pizza, you're getting po' boys, you're getting a meatball plate. The specials go a notch more upscale, but it's all New Orleans heart that goes a little bit off the typical New Orleans script of like the Mandinas and Layuses that are all around it.
Always something good in the barbecue pit that's going outside, too. Thank you, Ian McNulty. A pleasure, as always, or the smoker, whatever it is.
Absolutely.
Ian McNulty discovers food, dining culture for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate. Thank you, sir. We'll take a break, come back, find out what's going on with JR taking Vegas, and we'll tell you about my endeavor with the $5,000 stake that I put up. Right now, we pause for traffic on WWL. All right, here we go, 9:46, 14 till 10. I mentioned a $5,000 steak before. That's not a tomahawk ribeye, although, JR, if the price of beef goes up much more, you will be talking about a $5,000 steak as opposed to steake. How you doing?
I'm standing, man. I really am. And you know what? I know you. I feel a little bad.
No.
I really didn't give you the attention that I really knowing that we were going to be doing this bit every week, but and I mean that by I didn't put you on the list.
But wait, let me be honest about this, because I am a little different in that I like to do business with sportsbook. I don't like to do it online, so I like to travel to the sportsbook and make the bet. So there's a little level of complexity there as well.
That is true, and you and I spoke about that. That you know, for you to have to go to the book, I know you're going to only take 10 or 15 minutes, but it's so much easier to be able to shop the point spread, get the best point spread, and be able to do it all from the comfort of your living room. There's a lot to be said about that. I should have had you on the list early for the game on Saturday, which was the Cincinnati game. And I know you didn't get that one in, but that's okay.
Let me just tell people how we're doing. We did all right. I went a little bit off the campground there and went a little bit extra in the pile B and did very well with Texas Tech. And then I did do the Chargers game that you gave me, which didn't turn out, but I'm still up overall. So I just wanted to be fully transparent about that. That's not what you wanted me to do, and I won't do that from now on. I'll stick with exactly what you tell me. Tell me about money management and how it comes to a percentage of what your stake is and how it comes to – that's when it comes to what you're trying to do with me, percentage of what your stake is and when to buy down, when not to buy down, et cetera. Take us through all of it, JR.
All right. First off, let's give everybody something they can really – sink their teeth into this week, and that is going to be my SEC game of the month. I'm going to give everyone absolutely free when they text the word win to 545454. The point spread winner of the LSU South Carolina game, as well as the winner of the Alabama-Missouri game. So wow. SEC parlay of the month is free when you text the word win. That's WIN to the number 545454. Once again, LSU South Carolina, Alabama, Missouri, free via text. Text WIN to 545454. Now, as far as what we're doing, I've got a big move tonight. It's going to be my first Friday night move of the season for my VIP players. So when you and I get off the line, I'm going to be texting you a game that I do want you to get in tonight that I think is a complete and utter mismatch, and the line is way off. Okay,
do
so we're
going to
make money on Friday.
Okay,
and then we're going to have a couple of games tomorrow, a couple of games on Sunday. Now, what I'm looking to accomplish with you is we're going to do net wins. Okay, sometimes I do 5 games at a time and increase it based on whether it's a 5-0, 4-1, or 3-2, and we go up either 20% or we go up 50% or we go up 100%. What I'm doing with you, I like to refer to as my 50-33. In other words, every 3 net wins, we're going to increase by 50%, basically using the money that you just made from the sports book to increase your bets going up 50%. So from, let's say, 500 to 750. If we at any point, I don't care if we had 12 games in a row, 2 net losses, that does not have to be back-to-back losses, just 2 net losses, we're going to minus 33% from what we're doing. And what that basically manages is it brings you back down to where you were, okay? And it allows you to go up much faster. So in other words, if you're betting, let's say, 2,000 a game, and we get 3 net wins, and now you made, let's say, 6,000 off those 3 net wins, and we're going up to 3,000 a game because we're going to increase by 50%. If we lost the next 2 games or we went 1-3, we're basically giving back the 6,000 that you just made off the 3 net wins. So we're going to minus a third of 3,000, bringing us back to what we were betting at 2,000 a game. Now, 500, if you're in my VIP club, if you're dealing with me at a very bare minimum, you have to be betting 500. You and I are doing this very small scale just to give people an idea percentage-wise of what they'd be able to see. But normally I like to work with guys that are starting off betting 5,000 a game, not 500, right? So we're looking to go from 5K to 7,500 to 10,000 and so on and so forth. And that's what you're going to do. Every 3 net wins, we're going to add another 50% until I get you to the point where you can comfortably be betting between 2,000 and 10,000 a game using their money, house money. Now, in order to do that, I need to make you the first 50 grand. And in order to do that from 5,000, we call that the grind. That's the longest part of this entire journey. Getting your bankroll developed is going to take months on end to do. It's not going to happen in a week or two. It's going to take me 2 or 3 months to make that first 20 to 30,000, starting off at only 500 a game. But you're going to see 20% returns, 30, 50% returns week by week by week. And you watch your bankroll go from the 5,000 to maybe 6 to maybe 7,500 and then 10. And yes, we're going to have some setbacks. That happens. We're going to lose some games, but we're going to minus our bet in order to be able to go along with the fact that we're going to, because the percentage that we win has always been way over 60% with my VIP, you know, information, the games that I give to my clients. So, you know, saying that, we know we're going to hit at least I believe we're going to hit at a bare minimum 60 to 61% if the wheels fell off the cart. But we hit, like last year, college basketball, I hit 66% in college basketball. That's 2 out of every 3 games.
I know you did.
That's getting your bankroll from literally 5,000 to 25,000 in a month to a month and a half.
You did, and that's why I wanted to do this, JR, because basketball season was so good to me. Let's talk about the Colts last week. Your free pick on the air hit. Colts demolished the Raiders. What do you got for us this week?
Yeah, you know, I mean, the Colts have been great to us this year. I've used them, I think, 3 times out of the 5 weeks, and they've won every time for us. And, you know, this is a team that it had everything other than a legitimate quarterback. And there were obviously a lot of question marks this year. Now you look back and you can't believe there was even a controversy between Anthony Richardson and Daniel Jones. But they've been dynamite. You know, Jonathan Taylor's playing out of his skin right now. And the fact that opens up the passing game, which Daniel Jones has been Danny Dimes all season long. They're scoring on almost every possession, and their defense is in the top 5 in the league right now. They are just takeaways and great run defense. This is an all-around good team. So I'm sticking with it. Going against a team that blew it last week is fundamentally unsound. They're having too many penalties. Who drops a ball 10 inches from the end zone? Just the dumbest thing imaginable. We've seen it time and again. So I'm using the Colts again. Now, I started giving this out when it was -7. It's gone up to 7.5. So what I would say, just to be on the safe side, buy it down 1 point to -6.5. Get in the Colts, -6.5. Yes, you're going to pay more juice for that. Bet what you would normally bet, just make less money. But use the Colts, -6.5, to absolutely destroy the, again, the Cardinals this week.
Everything you just said about the money management is why I want you doing this, and I want you explaining it and why I wanted to do it so people understand how it works, because I understood about half of it, but I trust you. That's the deal. Take us out, JR.
So, look, again, it starts with winning, and right out the gate, that's what we're doing, guys. So if you're serious about doing this at the right way and you really want to make a score, I'm giving you the SEC Parlay of the Month absolutely free. All you got to do, text the word WIN to 545454. You'll get the winner of LSU South Carolina and the winner of Alabama Missouri absolutely free, and you get them via text. Text the word WIN to 545454. Be safe, have fun, and let's go out there and make some money.
And I will talk to you later on this weekend. Back in a flash, WWL.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.